Now entering Nerdist.com.
Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
You are listening to Maltin on Movies. Our guest today, how to begin to
have
introduce
you ever, Have you ever turned on your TV ever?
Yeah.
I think that's the closest. Have you ever turned on a television set?
Right.
Have you ever been sitting in a room that had a television set
right.
in it?
Right. Or strolled into a movie theater.
Or, yeah, yeah.
Lately, though, I would say television would be the dominant medium. Perhaps you listen to really good podcasts. If any of those things are true, you should know, and you do know, our guest, Stephen Tobolowsky.
Hello. So good to meet you.
Now, why is it, Stephen, that with the hundreds of credits you have and the many media in which you function, when someone says your name to me, other than the fact that we're friends, the first thing I think of is Ned Ryerson in Groundhog Day, after all these years?
It turned out to be a classic. You know, you never know what you do that will endure through time.
Yeah.
You know, usually as actors, we usually think that the really disastrous films we do are the ones that we're going to be known for, that will, you know, like Dr. Jekyll, Ms. Hyde.
Oh, well.
I'll be known for I'll be known for that one. But the Groundhog Day, I remember, maybe you remember, Leonard, when that movie came out, it was kind of damned with faint praise.
Mm-hmm.
The reviews were kind of good, but
yeah.
not great.
Yeah.
You know, kind of okay.
Yeah.
You know, Bill Murray moved kind of okay. And then I got a call from Trevor Albert, our producer, after the first month and said, Stephen, we're making more money here now in the beginning of the second month than we did in the first month. This is a great, great sign. And I was going, oh. And now it's become the new Wizard of Oz.
Oh, it's on all the time. They have screenings of it all the time. It is. It's become a pop culture reference.
It's really entered the zeitgeist, not just the zeitgeist. Yeah. The vernacular kind of.
And it's one of those rare things that now, when you say, "Oh, it's like Groundhog Day," no one's talking about Groundhog Day,
right?
They're talking about the movie.
They're talking about
an event that happens the day that recurs over and over again, mm-hmm. which of course has nothing to do with the real Groundhog Day.
No, right. Yeah. And the thing is, I'm
poor Punxsutawney.
I know, right? It ain't his fault.
He's been shoved aside.
No.
Shoved aside. No. Yeah.
I love pop culture. I'm fascinated by it over the years, and I'm also my dad and I like to talk about it a lot because obviously we like words. We like words in our family. And my dad especially likes words that I have to remind him not to use with his students because they just – you can see them as a unit go blank. He'll say something and I just see them all go, what? So it's we love the etymology of things. We like learning about all of it. And so for me, when something like that, people may not even realize it's a movie. There are people who may not know it's a movie. They just know that that's what you say. And that's when it really has entered its own universe.
Yeah,
that's
they don't
when
even know the origin
separate.
Of
They
the,
couldn't
the,
tell
the
you what it's from.
Yes.
I say fa-ra-ra-ra-ra. We're Jews at Christmas. You know, people always ask me what we're doing. And we're eating Chinese food, obviously. And I'll say fa-ra-ra-ra-ra. And they think it's funny, but they have no idea. But it's
from a Christmas
story. From a Christmas story, guys.
And kind of in a reverse of this, I did some research on the real Groundhog Day,
mm-hmm.
not the movie Groundhog Day, but the real Groundhog Day, which dates back, you know, its origins go back to Celtic roots 1,000 years ago. And believe it or not, one of the roots was to the Celtic god of weather prognostication.
Stop
really?
It.
And I talked to Danny Rubin, the screenwriter of Groundhog Day, and I said, Danny, did you know that actually the original Groundhog Day 1,000 years ago was in a way related to weather prognostication, and you have a weatherman, Phil Connors, as your lead? And Danny does one of these things where he gets that big smile like, I knew that, you know, but he'll never tell, you know, because he went to Harvard, you know, but Danny never, but you know, he goes, oh, sure, everyone knows it has to do with weather prognosis, but it's true. So in a way, there was more profundity in the truth of the story, I think, than anyone possibly knew.
I'm now imagining a groundhog in a kilt, you know,
It could happen.
A teeny tiny spore, in the whole thing, and
You know, you're good at graphics. You should.
Yeah. Right. Oh God.
You should follow up on that. Don't anyone else steal that idea.
Yeah. Right.
You heard it here first. Now listen. So I've mentioned this film, which is now more than 20 years old.
Yes.
But let's just bring people up to date a little bit.
Okay.
Just a little bit, because right now you are on two, not one, but it's not just that you're on two current TV series. You're on two really good current TV series, which
that
is...
That never happens to anyone at
one
all.
One of them is Norman Lear's reboot of his memorable sitcom One Day at a Time.
Yes.
Which has just been reinvented for a Cuban family and starring a wonderful actress that I was not familiar with named Justina Machado.
I'm saying the new Kathy Bates, right? I told you the new Kathy Bates. I'm telling you, she's not only hilarious, but she could rip your heart out in a second.
Yeah. Huh.
She doesn't you know, when you do a situation comedy, a lot of times as actors, we have to be a lot involved with the technical side of things. You really do have to hit your mark at a certain way because the cameras only have two passes kind of hitting you. And so sometimes as an actor, you get kind of astray with, am I supposed to be right here by the couch for this line? Justina never has a moment, ever, in rehearsal, in shooting, that isn't completely real, that isn't completely either. I mean, she will sometimes stop and go, wait a minute, what are we doing in this scene? But when she's in the scene, when we are working on the scene, every time she's like, what is that center of gravity? You know, it's that key in the earth that you go, that everything lines up. And to have her at the center of a show is such a powerful force because it keeps us all kind of honest.
And you play a wonderful character, Dr. Berkowitz, her employer.
Yes.
Who's a very benign, a little spacey, perhaps?
Well, a man who's dealt I almost think of him as kind of like a commedia character. There was a Puccinello or one of those commedia characters. I think that's the one that everything bad has happened to. And yet he's still kind of wistful and slightly optimistic and a bit philosophical. But his wife left him for an aerobics trainer. His children hate him. He's overwhelmed with his job. Nothing ever goes right for him. No one remembers his birthday. He's that guy. And yet, at the same time, he has a big heart for everyone around him and tries to make things work for everyone. So it's a dear, sweet part, and it's nice in the mix.
And this show strikes two blows against ageism. One, with the casting of the wonderful, wondrous Rita Moreno, who is an unbelievable 85 years old. You just wouldn't know, can't tell.
I have a shrine to her. I'm the reason she's alive because I sacrifice my blood, you know.
I have always said that Rita Moreno is proof that there is a God and that God plays favorites.
Right? Oh, my God.
She's quite wonderful. And, of course, the show is being supervised by its co-creator, Norman Lear. Who is now,
95?
95. And Norman is not just a figurehead on this show.
No. Norman Lear is so active. And you know, his only wish is that he could do more. His notes are brilliant. His insight is right on the money. I think he is a magnificent leader kind of at the helm, and whatever his energy allows him to do, he's really fantastic. He's certainly there for every major rehearsal and every shoot day and every network run through. He's always there.
That's wonderful.
With notes. And the thing about Rita, she ain't no 85. And I watch her. In fact, I watch a lot. It's one of the few shows I've been on that as an actor I want to watch everybody working on their scenes for different reasons. First, Justina, because she's so brilliant when she's on stage and working on things. Rita Moreno, besides being one of my idols, she was always an athlete. I believe she began professional dance lessons when she was five, according to her autobiography. I mean, she is a physical specimen still, and even at 85. And so she is the only person I've ever watched as an actor working on a role that first inhabits the role physically. She figures out what she wants her body to do, and then her voice kind of follows her body. Huh. I've never seen it before. And let me tell you, she could dance. She could still dance. Did you see any of the shows where she dances?
Yeah.
I mean,
episode two, she does.
Well, and she dances some, I believe, in episode four or and six, and she does a flamenco later in the season, which brought. When she came out and did the thing with the heels and the castanets, got full house applause from our live audience. I mean, it was magnificent. Yeah. I was like jaw to the floor.
Yeah.
I interviewed her last year at the TCM Classic Film Festival before a screening of The King and I. And it is astonishing, even to her, that she, though the parts were not major in the first two instances, she appears in three of the all-time great movie musicals. She's in Singin' in the Rain in a smallish role, but she's there.
Mm-hmm.
She has a more substantial role in The King and I as Tup Tim. And then, of course, West Side Story, which won her an Academy Award.
West Side Story.
I mean, and West Side Story is a long time ago.
Yeah.
and here she is. Still killing it.
And you want to talk about sitting around talking about theater stories. You know, as an actor, you love talking about theater stories. Well, West Side Story was one of my all-time favorites. And where we're shooting at the Sony lot used to be the MGM lot, as you know. And Rita said, I filmed part of America right down this road.
Oh, my gosh.
And,
I can't.
And, she, and I don't want to misquote any of her stories, but that particular number took weeks to shoot. And you know the whole story where the floor was raised so you get the camera so you could watch them. And Jerome Robbins was the choreographer right on that show, and she said the man was an absolute sadist, vicious, you know.
Known as a tyrant.
He was a tyrant, just vicious. And if he asked me today to do something, I'd jump. I'd go, yes, please.
There you are. Well, okay, so that's one of the shows that you're on. The other show that you've just joined in its third season is Silicon Valley.
Hilarious.
And indeed, I've just started. I had dropped. I'd watched it when it was on, and then I sort of drifted. And because I wanted to see you, Alice and I started watching season three. And we're so glad we did, because we were laughing out loud right away. And you've got a great part.
It's a very good part. I had a discussion with Mike Judge, the creator, and you know, everybody is kind of – it's hard to describe what happens on Silicon Valley, because what happens, everybody does – the scripts are written so carefully and beautifully, but there's so many people who improvise on that show that there's always – as you – you know, you put down what was written, and then people start doing things that are not in the script. And so when that happens, the important thing is you kind of have to know who your character is to properly improvise.
Mm.
You know, you can't really say something that's out of character. And I was talking to Mike and Alec, the executive producers on the show, of what I thought of my character, Jack Barker. And
Action said, Jack Barker.
Action Jack Barker is that – I said, if you don't know Silicon Valley, my elevator version of Silicon Valley, which is what the version that takes you from floor one to floor two,
right.
It's that short, right? The short elevator version is that it is about Richard Hendricks, a young genius engineer who has invented fire. It's like he's invented
fire. Pretty much, yeah.
He's invented something that would change the way all computers will work all over the world from now on. And the show is about the quest for fire. Mm-hmm. Not only Richard trying to make his dreams become reality, but also everyone else who's either trying to steal it, to sabotage it, to do so. It brings out the best and worst of humanity, and it's a fantastic metaphor for creativity.
Yeah.
And so the show is quite outrageous and quite hilarious. And I said that Richard needs a suitable adversary. And because you have a lot of jerks on the show, naturally,
yeah.
I said, but I said, the one thing about Action Jack Barker is I don't lie.
Huh.
Which makes me incredibly dangerous because you don't really know what truth I'm telling. But I don't lie to people. I tell them the truth, but it's not what they think they hear. And I'm a bit of a shapeshifter. I will work to be either Richard's salvation or I will work to destroy him. And he never knows which it is in the moment. But yeah. it's delightful. And the work we've been doing this year is just fantastic.
Yeah.
Even the first episode, I read the first episode this season and said, oh, my gosh, they're doing this? It's amazing. And that is what's really brilliant about that show is Mike Judge, who was, I think, some sort of computer engineer at one mm-hmm. point in time, besides being a bass player in Dallas, Texas, which mm-hmm. I didn't know, is that Mike, these guys have to stay ahead of the curve because, you know, they have to write things that are coming
yes.
up in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So they have to do their research of what's coming down the pike.
Yep.
And
everyone has to sound like they know what they're talking about, not just saying code and what have you.
Hard
they have to make
learn.
It seem like they understand. Oh, man.
But it's a wonderful show.
Now, what's it like knowing that the folks you're working with in so many of these scenes are not only actors but really great improvisers and that they might throw you a curve or two or three?
You learn very quickly that in any scene – you are going to be the butt of the joke.
Right.
It is rare that they are, you are. I remember the very first scene was with T.J. Miller that I shot.
I love that man.
T.J. is hilarious. So in the script, T.J. was to insult me for ageism, hello,
right,
for being
course.
An old man.
Well, that's his whole thing. That's part of his character is just, you know, you peasants.
Yeah.
You peasants know nothing.
So he was going to put me down. And in the script, there's like three, you know, I say like, well, you know, I'm a big fan of yours. And he says, a big fan of what? Metamucil? You
right.
know, big fan of, you know, a nice piece of fish. Big fan of – and so in the script, there's like about three different comments he's supposed to make. And I'm getting ready to say my line. But TJ keeps going.
Right.
Oh, yeah. But he keeps going for 5 minutes. And he keeps coming with the insults. And then I see Alec Berg crawling on the floor under the camera. He's our executive producer, one of the writers, crawling on the floor and handing TJ an envelope. And on the back of the envelope is a list of more insults. So I
it's like starting with Yo Mama jokes.
Right? Oh, my gosh.
I am there, and at first, I am straight-faced, you know, as TJ starts this list of things.
Yes.
After about the second minute, I can't help it, and I start laughing. Now, they're shooting over – they have two shots going close-up of TJ and over my shoulder,
yeah.
and my shoulders are just
bouncing. Oh.
And I'm trying to just keep it down. I'm trying not to laugh, and TJ is kind of looking at me, and he's still going and going and going. We finish that take, and I come up to – Mike and to TJ, I said, I'm so sorry. I am so sorry. I couldn't keep a straight face with all that. And TJ says, oh, are you kidding? I love this. I'm a comedian.
Yeah.
And I need to hear people laughing. And I hate it when these professional actors come in here and they decide they're going to stay in character. At least with you, I know that it's all working.
Right.
And I said, Mike, I'm so sorry that I – he says, oh, don't worry about it. We're shooting this in 4K, which means we'll just cut around you. You know, they have so much information
sure.
in the chip that they can do editing in the camera and move it to a different shot.
Isn't that amazing?
Amazing. Yeah. Indeed.
And you also, on the show, it's Kumail Nanjiani, Nerdist's own Kumail, who is one of the – he's another one we talk about sometimes and even on the podcast how comedians or people who are really, really great at making people laugh also seem to have an incredible connection to the serious – side of things. And so they tend to be able to like you're saying with Justine, it's like they can also break your heart. They're really, really funny, but they can also completely break your heart. And Kumail's one of those people. And I love seeing how much he's working because he's so talented.
He's so good.
He's so talented.
I mean, if you take a look at any comedy that's really good
yeah.
and certainly Silicon Valley, so many others, Groundhog Day, it doesn't work unless at the very core of it, it is true.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So one thing you could say that links all great comedic actors, comedians, Louis C.K., Pam Adlon, all these great, great performers is they all have a sense of truth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you could be as wacky as you want like TJ, but what makes TJ funny is we grab onto that element of truth of the guys who feel insecure about themselves, want to blow themselves up, and want to be – and that's why on Silicon Valley, when TJ – I don't want to do spoiling, but
no, don't, you know, do that.
Yeah, no. When different characters act and do actions that are not what we would expect their actions to be, and every one of those main guys has a moment of, for want of a better word, you would call nobility.
Mm.
And we're shocked by it sometime because we already believe them.
Mm.
We believe them. We have a sense of what their truth is, and we are delighted and surprised that our truth contains more than what we originally saw. And we identify with that as nobility. But it wouldn't happen if the actor didn't know truth to begin with.
Mm. Now, by any chance, did you see Office Christmas Party?
No, not yet.
I know people's reaction to it in general, but I went and saw it. And the most incredible thing that it's capable of that it does is the heart. So as ridiculous as it is and over the top and crazy, and I was so thankful I wasn't watching it with my parents and, you know, all of that. And TJ plays a sort of similar to who he is in Silicon Valley, but not with the same, but he doesn't have the ego. He's just incredibly wealthy and he runs a company that his father ran and he's running it into the ground because he's such a nice person who he spends too much money. But so for all of the crazy in it, the best thing that he does is you still really like him, and at certain points you love him. So as nutty as he gets, he maintains that. And I said to my husband afterwards, I went, I really like that movie. And part of why I really like that movie was I wanted him to succeed.
Yeah.
I wanted him to get what he wanted to get.
It's a little theory that I have now about drama. It's twofold. Any successful dramatic or comedic piece is about revealing what is hidden.
Mm.
It's Bill Murray discovering time has stopped. It's any of the Nocturnal Animals, Amy Adams getting to the end of the book and getting to the restaurant. Yeah. Everything is about what is hidden.
Mm.
The revelation of that relationship. And that is a very important kind of that's, I think, one of the elements that holds all kind of drama together is what's hidden. And a joke is a combination of what we see and what is hidden. So what we see is usually the setup, and what is hidden is the punchline.
Mm-hmm.
And usually it's hiding in plain sight. I'll give you an example of a joke here that's really hilarious. And that is, how do you capture a unique rabbit?
I give up.
Unique up on it. Now, see, it's hilarious because the answer was hiding in plain sight. But the profundity of the joke, as anyone knows, rabbits is that the English language is just as unpredictable as a rabbit. And that's what we laugh at.
Now, you've been waxing philosophical for us here, which is what you do on your wonderful podcast, The Tobolowsky Files, to which my wife and I have been listening addictively. And you haven't updated it lately because you've been too busy making a living, poor guy. But the back files are there to be savored and enjoyed. And you have more recently started putting some of your stories down on paper. And a couple of years ago, you made your debut as an author,
yes,
a published author.
Wow.
With a wonderful collection called Dangerous Animals Club, published no less by Simon & Schuster. And I have here in my hands an advanced copy of your next book, My Adventures with God, again to be published by Simon & Schuster in April, correct?
That is correct.
And congratulations on that.
Thank you.
You tweeted a photo reading this to your dad. And I sent it to my parents so they could see it because the photo made me so emotional. It was so sweet. First of all, you look just like your dad, which is something I relate to because I am identical to that one. But it's such a lovely thing. And then my dad was telling me when you two spoke about it that your story sort of brought him
In kind of my adventures with God, I have a – it's like Dangerous Animals Club in that I have a – I think like 33 or 31, however many that they let me keep in there.
Right.
33 or 31 stories, and they're broken into five categories based on the template of the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got Genesis, which are stories of our family, where we came from. Then we all go into slavery, like in Exodus or graduate school. Or then when we escape, we're still in the middle of the desert. And we don't know where we're going. And then we have a Leviticus moment where we say, this is what I am. And that's when people usually join a gym. Or no, this is it. And then death comes into our life. And unfortunately, mortality with friends and family. And it changes who we are. And then at the end, Deuteronomy, we tell our stories, like Moses told to the Jewish people, the Hebrew children, what we were doing, because they've already forgotten what they were doing because they were wandering for 39 years. And so you tell your stories to see if it makes sense. So I'm bringing this book because my father now is Norman Lear's age,
mm-hmm.
a little younger, but he's what we call a Texas 94, not a Hollywood 94.
Explain.
Well, a Hollywood, like right now, I am 65 years old, but I'm a Hollywood 65 years old, which means I'm more like 54. Wouldn't you say 54 or 5?
Absolutely.
Something like that.
I'd put you at a solid 50.
Norman Lear is a Hollywood 95, which means he's a solid 82.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas my father is a Texas 94.
So he's about 180.
180.
Yeah. Okay.
So he's blind.
It's all that two-stepping.
Oh, well, he wishes. He's blind. He can't walk. He could hardly hear. Now he's at the point where he can't really remember things. So he doesn't have any kind of dementia, but it's just his brain's not working, partly because he can't hear or see. And so he asks again, now, what are we doing today? What are we doing today?
Mm-hmm.
The thing over and over again. So I was bringing this book to a neighbor of his, Rosie Bauer. And Rosie is also aged, and she has dinner with Dad and helps him. And she's a very dear, sweet woman, and I thought she could entertain him by reading stories from this book, because the stories in this book have to do with us kids when we were little,
mm-hmm.
stories of my mom who's passed away, mm-hmm. stories of Dad's family, his mother, his father, and brothers and sisters, and as we grew up, our children and how our children grew up. I thought Dad would love that. It's better than a photo album because he can't see anymore.
Right. Yeah.
So I'm taking it over to Rosie, and my brother says, well, what are you doing with that book? I mentioned the plan. He says, well, why don't you go in there now and read to Dad? And I thought, oh, well, I don't know if he – well, why not? You're a professional actor. Go ahead and try
it.
So I'm thinking, like, what story will I read? And I picked – The Garden on Orchid Lane, which is a story about his father, Dad's father and mother who lived on Orchid Lane, and all of his brothers and sisters. So we go in there, and Paul says, Dad, we got a big surprise for you. Stephen is going to read for you. And Dad goes, if he has to. So I said, well, Dad, you may recognize some of the people in this book. And I started reading the story. His eyes fill up with tears, and he starts laughing, and he puts his hand over his mouth to keep from laughing too hard. Then he starts laughing harder and harder, saying, that's just like Papa. That's just like Papa. And then he's talking about my Uncle Sylvan was a tax attorney and used to handle a lot of big stars like Jackie Gleason and mm-hmm. people. He used to do their taxes. And I said, I'm 5 years old at the time in the story, that I loved my Uncle Sylvan because there was a dignity about him that the rest of the family didn't have. He never treated me like a child. He always treated me like a client. And, And so he sits down and Uncle Sylvan explains to me the difference between morality and ethics using football. And I don't understand it at all. And my father is just laughing so hard. And it made me feel what I was talking before about comedy.
Yeah.
It made me before, if there wasn't truth in there, Dad wouldn't have laughed.
Right.
And one of the amazing things about one of the stories, it has a story of his aunt, my aunt Sarah, Dad's sister. And that particular day in the story, she brings me a paint-by-numbers kit of this garden. And I have never known paint-by-numbers before. And I look at the picture and I said, I can't paint this. And she says, sure you can, Stevie. Just look at the numbers and keep within the lines. And I said, the world felt so generous that there was this artist that had done this for me. And if I just kept everything within the right lines and used the right color, I could have a beautiful picture that would be mine. And I spent that afternoon, and I never thanked my father and mother for spending that, letting me stay all afternoon painting that picture. I painted the picture of the garden, and Aunt Sarah said, we have to keep it here to dry. And she put it up on a shelf for it to dry. And the next week when I came back after Sunday school, she said, well, you could take it home now. I said, well, you know, I like it here. I painted it here. How do you like it? She says, well, I like it very much, Stevie. I'll tell you what, I'll keep it for you until you're ready to take it home. And about 10 years ago, I got the call that everyone in the house and the family had died, like within like a couple months, and the house had gone up on the market. And my sister-in-law, my brother's wife, said, if you want any of the good stuff, you better run back and get it.
Yeah.
So I flew back to Dallas. The house was picked clean. Nothing. Old magazines were gone. TV was gone. My grandfather's chair was gone. The piano was gone. Nothing was there. I go through the kitchen hoping maybe the jug where my granny kept her cookies was there. Open the door, nothing. Then I see this dull glow in the back of a cabin, and I reach. It was my grandfather's menorah, Hanukkah menorah, from when my father was a boy, from the 1920s. They had left that behind, and I'm looking, and the whole place is just an ugly house from the 1950s, nothing left. And I see this bit of color out of the corner of my eye, green and pink. And I look, and it is my painting, my paint-by-number picture that I did when I was five. And so I climb up, and I pull it home, take it home. And so my Aunt Sarah was right. She kept it for me until I was ready to take it.
See, and now I'm tearing up.
Yeah, right? I'm not crying. You're crying.
And I don't know how you do that, Stephen, but you do it. And this is why we listen to you. And your stories, I must say, I was very impressed when I first read Dangerous Animals Club because I didn't know if they would translate to the printed page. So much of their impact is your telling of the stories, which is why we love listening to you. But they work on the page, too, which is quite amazing, which means that's how good a storyteller you are.
I have learned doing the different media that it's a matter of time. And like when you're doing comedy in one day at a time and mm-hmm. you're in front of a live audience, you have time. If you have a bit that's working, and that's why Norman Lear says he always wants theater people because they know mm-hmm. how to ride those waves like mm-hmm. surfers. Mm-hmm. If the audience is laughing, like if Rita and I are doing a bit and the audience starts laughing, we both know how to play it to not kill the laugh. You have time.
Mm-hmm.
When you do an audible story, when you're doing like a podcast mm-hmm. and telling a story, you have less time.
Mm-hmm.
But you still have some time to play with the audience and play with the microphone. When you write the printed word, the audience is smart. They get ahead of you so fast, you have to cut stuff out to keep ahead of them because the audience, they already, now see, that last sentence was unnecessary. See the audience, because I already said the audience is fast, so you don't need me saying they get ahead of you, right?
So few people understand this, though. I've had this in my career where people say something I created for a magazine or something I created for a book, you should put that online. And I say, no, it was meant to be just a little, you know, capsule thing in a paperback book, and that's what it was created to be. It will not translate. A Chorus Line was meant to be a live theatrical experience. It was never destined to be a movie. Nobody could make that a movie, and they proved that they couldn't make it a movie by making it a movie. The medium does affect the content.
When I worked on Wild Hogs, had a long conversation with John Travolta and the war he had in doing Saturday Night Fever, I guess, with John Badham. And John Travolta had worked on his dance for that for like 6 months, you know, the disco dance he does. And John Badham, magnificent director, but he was going to do it a la the style of the day, which was a lot of fast cuts, which was typical. And John Travolta said, no, you have to shoot this from floor to ceiling like you shot Fred Astaire. And John Travolta was a young guy.
He Fred Astaired it.
You have to do it floor. He says, because I'm actually doing it.
Right.
If you don't do that, it's like you're saying, in a dance, the audience will think there is an edit, there is a cheat. Every edit is a cheat. And John Travolta wanted to show the audience that he wasn't cheating, and he did. And that's why he became the world's biggest star.
Now, in addition to telling your stories and printing and publishing your stories, you've also done something else quite remarkable. Very few people can claim this. You ran a successful Kickstarter campaign in order to do a state-of-the-art multi-camera shoot of a one-person concert you did in Seattle telling your stories. And it is now available on all platforms of VOD and such. And it's called The Primary Instinct.
Primary Instinct, wow.
So if you're being captured or captivated by Stephen's talking here and you're falling under his spell, you got to watch this. And but besides that plug, I want to say how impressed I am that you and your partner, David Chen, pulled this off. How did you do this?
I have no idea. It's like the bee, you know. They said there's no way the bumblebee could fly. David says, like, Stephen, do you want to do a movie of some of your stories? I go, well, sure. He says, well, we have to come up with a date. This was in January. So we said, well, how about May? That'll give me some time to write these stories and put them together. David, we had to figure out how to do a Kickstarter campaign, so I wrote podcasts that would only go to the contributors. So that took a while to do. We raised, let's see, about $55,000. We figured we needed 40. Kickstarter takes some of that money, and then other people don't pay their pledges. So we had enough, but what we didn't have, which was crazy, when people do these live concerts, they do it over multiple days. And the actors just wear the same clothes. So you could cut it all together and you get the best. We only had one day, which meant that not only the cameras couldn't make a mistake, not only I couldn't make a mistake, but the greatest intangible, the audience had to be good. If we came in and the audience wasn't good, there was nothing we could do about it. And the audience was magnificent. They listened and the stories were good. And I will never do that again. Why was that hard?
I do think that having bodyguards at the exits blocking them was a little extreme. Did you really have to go to that degree?
Daddy, he got stun guns in bulk. Saved money.
It's Seattle, you know. We just had to pass out the reefers at intermission, and that kept him there.
Anyway, congratulations.
Thank you.
Because that is no small achievement.
No, Primary Instinct is, I will always look at it as one of the great achievements of my life, that David and I did it, because it was so difficult. And the movie is very moving and very effective and very funny. It's amazing how well it works, considering we really didn't have a lot of opportunities to get it right.
Well, good for
Incredible
you.
Incredible how that
Thank
happens.
Thank you. Thank you.
Years ago, bear with me now. Years ago, I heard a story. Danny Thomas, the comedian and star, had a brief acting career. And he came out to Hollywood in the 40s, and he worked in a movie with the great Walter Huston. A pause for Walter Huston.
Walter Huston.
Yes, one of the greats. And Walter Huston said to him something like, "Kid, don't ever let them put your name over the title, and you'll work forever." Referring to, of course, character actors. And you are a character actor. And you just keep working.
Mm.
I'll tell you a bit of advice that was given to me by Richard Crenna. Mm-hmm. We were working together on a TV movie in Thailand in which I learned that Richard Crenna was the funniest person ever on the face of the earth, ever. And after that, I worked with Mel Gibson. And he said, "Oh, you work with Richard Crenna, funniest guy in the world, right?" Richard Crenna, funniest guy in the world. He said, if you are an actor and you have a lead in a 30-minute sitcom, you're fine. You could do movies. But if you are an actor and you have a lead in a one-hour drama in which your name is above the title, which you are the title, you will have difficulty doing movies.
Mm.
That was his formula.
Mm.
So I take a look at Patrick Dempsey. I take a look at different people who starred in one-hour shows. Now I guess it's not necessarily true, but maybe not because the movie industry is so different now.
Things are blurring.
It's blurring.
And it's changing and evolving constantly and reinventing itself now. Certainly television is reinventing itself. And
yeah.
And all of the new platforms have a lot to do with that. And this leads me to ask you if you will tell the story of your most recent audition. Because auditioning is the cross that actors have to bear. And I don't understand how you folks do it. I truly don't. I've never been in that position.
Mm-mm.
I've had to, go pitch myself or pitch ideas for freelance jobs and things like that. So I know that kind of nervousness. But it's not the same thing, not remotely the same thing as having to put yourself in that position. And you recently found yourself in that position for yet another TV project.
Are you talking about the Jamie Foxx thing?
Yeah, uh-huh.
Boy, well, first of all, drum roll, in that White Famous with J. Farrow, Jamie Foxx, picked up by Showtime. Magnificent. Found out yesterday. And this is not so much an audition, but maybe a tale that the essence of the tale has a lesson in it. And that is, I'm busy doing all these shows, and the casting director of Californication, Felicia Fasano, said, "Stephen, we're doing a reading of White Famous, a new prospective show for Showtime, and we're so sorry we didn't call you in to audition. We know you're too busy. Your schedule isn't going to work. We have an offer out to someone else. Can you just come in and read it for the network with everybody else, just as a cast reading?"
Mm.
And I'm thinking, let's see. It was Monday at 5 o'clock at Sony is this reading. I'm doing these other shows. Do I need to go over there and just read? Sure. So I drive the 2 hours in the traffic to go over to Sony. And I'm sitting there with all the other actors, and out there are the people from Lionsgate and from Showtime and all the executive producers. And everyone at the table is scared to death, because that's when actors get fired.
Right.
You know, at these big network things, actors get – and I am not going to get fired, because there's no way I'm even a part of the show.
Yeah.
And everybody comes up and apologizes for having me – drive there. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you so much, Stephen. And I'm thinking, like, sure, we're getting ready to read. And the girl next to me who's reading, she says, "You're so calm." I go, "Yeah.
Right.
I'm the only one who's got nothing on the line, pal."
I was going to say, you should just look at her and say, "You should be terrified."
So I went ahead and just read the part. And I get a call from my manager that night. He goes, "Why do you think I'm calling you?" And I said, "Maybe to find out how the reading went today." "Well, what if I told you I already knew how the reading went today?"
I really hope he sounds like that.
He does.
Good.
Yeah. And I said, "Well, maybe then to talk about Silicon Valley." "Stephen, you got the part. And I go, what? Not only did I get the part, but they rewrote the script to give me the same character that I had in Californication.
Huh.
They changed it to Stu Beggs. And so I shot it 2 days later with Jamie Foxx and Jay Pharoah in and out, and a spectacularly funny show. I mean, again, it's one of those shows that I used to say to people about Californication, not for everyone.
Right?
And man, I got to say, Jamie Foxx, so funny in this. Jay Pharoah, so funny in this. And Stu makes an appearance in the show. It is hysterical. But I'm so – congratulations to the guys. Go beyond Showtime this year, and a phenomenal show, White Famous.
It's great.
Yeah, hilarious. Yeah.
But there's a kind of a lesson there, though, isn't there?
I think there's a lesson in that. My lesson is you got to say yes.
Mm.
If you're an actor, you have to say yes. Once you start saying no, you're in trouble.
Yep.
I think, you know, I've had a lot of curious auditions. I had one. I don't do on-screen commercials.
Right.
Right? I was advised not to do that, even though now big stars, you know, they go over to Japan and do on-screen commercials, make a ton of money. But they said, never do on-screen commercials. I get a phone call from my agent saying, you know, they're doing this Orlando super, you know, Universal Orlando commercial, and this could be a seven-figure job. And for you folks out there who aren't used to, you know, addition, what they mean is $1 million, right? Over $1 million for this job. So I make a U-turn to go back for this audition.
Of course.
Like, man, I will do an on-screen audition for a commercial that could get me $1 million. I walk in, and as we were talking about, we may or may not have been recording, but about you go in on an audition.
Yeah. And no, it's just before, we were talking off mic, so let's
you
set
see
that up.
Everybody that looks exactly like you, right?
And you're all used to each other for the most part because you see each other at everything. So it's everyone who is 6 foot something, glasses, possibly balding.
Bald.
Like, and it is a strange, it's surreal if you don't know what's going on.
Bald.
You think
50,
that there's some
glasses.
Sort of, there's like a doppelganger cult that we're not aware of.
The only difference was, okay, so there's 50 guys in there that are bald, have glasses, in their 50s. This was a while back.
Yeah.
In the 50s. And the thing is, they're all asleep.
Oh, my God.
I mean, they're all in there. I'm thinking, how long did these poor suckheads have to wait in here for this audition? They're all there. They're nodding off. They're snoring.
Oh,
they're all
God.
Nodding off. And I go up to the casting director and said, listen, I was just called to come over here. I don't have all day to wait.
Yeah.
So maybe could you just kind of get me in and out because I have another audition to go to? And they go, sure, we'll get you right in next, Stephen. No problem. We'll get you right in. So I come in, and there is a first-class plane seat there. And the director's going, all right. Here's the commercial, Stephen. Here's the commercial. You have a vacation to Orlando, and you're there with your wife and your child, and you're there, and you have just eaten a big meal, and you watch a little bit of movie, and you're sound asleep. You're sound asleep, and the little kid is looking out the window at the flight. I go, and then I'm thinking, sound asleep. The guys out in the lobby were just practicing. They were just practicing their part, you know. So I said, excuse me. So like, I'm – the commercials, I'm asleep. I
right,
mean,
right,
do I wake
right.
up or anything? No. You're dead out. I said, so I'm auditioning that I'm dead out.
Yes.
That I'm asleep. Okay. So I said – and I had my seatbelt on, right? Your seatbelt on, you're dead out. So I did the seatbelt on, and I like close my eyes, and I think, now how can I steal some of the stuff I saw the guys doing in the lobby out there? So I start like, you know, you start doing the curly snore or something. But then you think, well, no, don't do that. Just be asleep. So I'm asleep. He goes, okay. Well, let's try another one because that just kind of lay flat, didn't it? I go, okay. Well, just question now. I'm unconscious, right? I'm totally unconscious.
Right.
Totally dead out. I
right.
said, okay. Well, let's do it again, and I'll just try to have a different kind of dream. I don't know. So I didn't get that job. But that is the kind of indignities. You were talking before about how do actors do it? How do we do stuff like that?
I don't know how the hell you do it.
And keep a straight face.
Oh, man.
I took some friends to an audition once where it was, we didn't even know what it was initially. They'd just gotten called from, I was with them, they got called from their agent, so we just went over and walked into the room of the same, of the doppelganger cult. And what each one was going in and doing is it was a PSA for birth control.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you had to go in and cry while throwing up
no.
in a toilet. That was it. You had to go in and sob hysterically and cry while hugging a toilet seat. And it would, I guess, somehow it would come over, you know, the more you know, birth control. And I couldn't stop laughing to the point where I had to walk outside. Because here's all these people. You're sitting around a bunch of method people who have their headphones on and God knows what they're listening to. Maybe it's the sound of weeping children. I don't know. And they're sitting there rocking back and forth. And then because the walls are not thick, you're hearing each one going, ah, what is this? This is insane. And my friend is looking at me, you know, like, this is normal. And I said, no, this is not normal. Nothing about this situation is normal. I understand, but holy hell. And the other thing was watching the girls come out because they're all red-faced, you know, and especially the ones who were wearing, like, who'd come in, like, sexy outfits. I guess they were told jeans and a T-shirt, but some of them were like, oh, jeans that one paints on. And a T-shirt appropriate for a wet T-shirt contest type of a thing. And they're just, like, sobbing, mascara down the face. And I'm like, nobody would believe you. If you didn't know how crazy auditions can be and what they can ask you to do, you know, you've read the ones where they're trying to find the chemistry with two actors. I think it's George Clooney and Jennifer Lopez where they put them in a trunk.
There was going to be a trunk,
sort of a love scene, and that's how they had them try together. Was in the trunk of a yeah. You all are special.
You know, when I first came out to L.A., you don't know anyone. And it's a desperate time, so you look to try to find people from your hometown that you – well, as a matter of fact, when I came out to L.A., one of the first people from my hometown, Kay Callan from Oak Cliff, was on a show called One Day at a Time with Norman Lear. And right when I came to Los Angeles, she says, Stephen, would you like to see them make a television show? And I ended up – one of the first things I did out here was seeing – One Day at a Time and meeting Norman Lear.
How wild
that was like a calling.
Serendipity.
One of the first auditions I had was, let's put on your thinking caps. like royalty from Dallas, Texas came out here to make a film, Larry Buchanan.
Mm-hmm.
Does that name ring a bell?
Yeah, it does.
Larry Buchanan wrote and directed
The Killer Shrews.
Yes.
Oh,
and
geez.
More famously, Mars Needs Women.
Yes.
With Tommy Kirk.
Tommy Kirk.
Yes.
Mars Needs Women. So the word was that Larry Buchanan was going to be making a new film out here, and he wanted, and all the people from Dallas could get into audition. So this was desperate times for us. So I sign up, and I'm waiting in the little waiting room with all the Dallas people. And finally, he calls back. The secretary calls me back to meet the great man, Mr. Buchanan. And I said, well, you know, Mr. Buchanan, we really never got a script on what the new movie is. What is the new movie? Well, Stephen, the new movie is, you know, this guy sounds a lot like my manager.
A little bit, yeah. I wasn't going to say anything.
Stephen, this movie is called Mars Still Needs Women.
Stop it.
And I see. So what part do you think maybe I'd be right for? He says, well, that's interesting you ask that. You know, Stephen, I've done a lot of things in this business. I've directed, I've written, I've worked on the crew, I've done lights. But there's one thing I don't know, and that's air conditioning. My air conditioner here is broken. Do you know how to fix an air conditioner? And we stood in awkward silence for a while, and I go, no, sir. He goes, well, thank you. You could go. And that was my audition.
Boy.
If I couldn't do the air conditioning, I was gone.
Well, too bad.
Yeah, but I think he did make the movie, didn't he, Mars? Or maybe
– Well, I'm not sure.
I'm
prepared to say whether that's true or not.
The phone's coming out.
Yes.
Mars still needs women.
While you're checking that.
Yes.
Since people do go to their devices a lot and check things, and everybody can Google things and IMDb things and do all that kind of stuff, If they look you up,
yes,
you have a substantial list of acting credits, but there's also an interesting screenwriting credit.
Yes.
That people, you know, might not expect to see.
That is correct. Boy, that's a very interesting story. I was,
and it's a whole podcast, so I'm going to ask you to tell it.
It would appear that there is no Mars needs more, still needs more women. Okay. Mars needs more women.
Mars still needs women. No, you got to get it right if you're going to look the damn thing up.
I typed it in. Mars still needs women. Okay. No. Nothing done come up.
Oh, well, because
nope.
No one fixed the air conditioner, so that was that.
Right?
Scrap
the project. It's too hot in here.
My girlfriend many years ago was a rising star, Beth Henley, and she won the Pulitzer Prize for Crimes of the Heart. And when you're a rising star like Beth, you meet other rising stars, and one of them being director Jonathan Demme.
Mm-hmm. Never heard
who
of
had just done the Howard Hughes.
Melvin and Howard.
Melvin and Howard, which was magnificent. So anyway, Jonathan was working on this concert film with David Byrne and the Talking Heads, Stop Making Sense. And so Beth and I were walking from exercise, and Jonathan pulls his car over. Hey, you two, where are you going? You want to come see my new movie? So we drive over to the Academy. I'd never been to the Academy before. We go in, and I'd never heard the Talking Heads before. I am sitting next to David Byrne. Tina is there, and Chris, and Jerry. They're all there, just the Talking Heads, in this 2,000-seat theater. And we watch Stop Making Sense, and it's magnificent. Amazing. And afterwards, David goes out with Beth and me, and he asks, what's wrong with the movie? Because he wants please be honest with me.
Yeah.
And so we get into this big conversation. And somehow through that conversation, I ended up being asked by David if I maybe would write on a project he was working on called True Stories, to do a movie of true stories that he came across on various band trips around the country.
Okay.
and put together. So I wrote the initial screenplay for the movie True Stories. And in that, you know, Beth was saying to David, David said he wanted the stories in the movie to all be fantastical but true in some way. And Beth said, well, you got to talk to my sweetie because he can hear tones. And David looks at me and goes, you hear tones? And I told David the story of this psychic experience I had when I was 19 years old in college. And David found it enormously hilarious. So after Beth joined me on the screenplay, we turned the thing in. A year later, I'm driving my car and there's a knock on my window. It's David Byrne on a bicycle. And he said, sorry, I haven't been in touch, been working on the movie. I changed a lot of the stuff you did in the movie anyway, but are you going to be home this afternoon? I go, sure, David. There's something I want you to hear. So we go to our house, and David pulls out his little cassette, and he sticks it in, and he says, so I really like that hearing tones thing, that story. So I made one of the characters in the movie hear tones, and I wrote a song based on that called Radiohead. And so the song in True Stories, Radiohead, was based on my story that I told David about when I was in college. And that movie came out, I think, in like 88. And in 1991, in England, the band called On a Friday decided they had a band meeting and said, we have to change our name. On a Friday is no good. They all love David Byrne, and they all love the movie True Stories, and they love the song, so they changed their name to Radiohead. So the band Radiohead got their name from my experiences when I was 19 years old in movement class.
It just doesn't stop, folks.
It doesn't stop.
It just doesn't stop.
It's too weird.
There's so many ripples in your stream.
My jaw's dropped. I'm just imagining now that I hope every single Radiohead album has just a photo of you, you know, in the sleeve. I want there to be a big picture of you, preferably one where you're doing that, like, chin holding up the head thing and looking, gazing deeply, hopefully in black and white too, gazing deeply into someone's eyes.
The thing that fascinates me is essence. And one thing David did in that, besides, one thing that makes David so brilliant is that he is able to capture essence. And when I told the story about my psychic experience. And watching Beth watch me tell the story, there was this kind of little joy we shared because it was so much of our past in that story. That was like our first date, is kind of around that psychic experience. And there was that joy. And that song that David wrote captured the joy of the beginning of my relationship with Beth like an insect in amber. You know, it was so perfect. He was able to translate that joy musically, and it's phenomenal. I love the song still. Love it, love it, love it.
Can I say, true story, Radiohead is now changing their name to Insect in Amber. That is, that's what they're,
remember, you heard it here first.
They're moving on.
You heard it here first, folks.
Henceforth be known.
Another scoop.
Insects in Amber.
Oh, my. Oh, my, Stephen, we could go on and on and on, obviously. And this is why you never run out of material.
No.
Because not only have you had so many wonderful experiences and interesting experiences.
And horrible experiences.
And horrible experiences. But remarkably, and I don't know how you do this, you remember them all.
I just finished writing a new podcast. As a matter of fact, I've recorded two new podcasts that'll start coming out soon. And I'm just finishing. I've written five new ones now. But one of them is about how I don't remember. So,
all right. I'll table that comment then until we hear that.
Yes. But it is, I do have a good memory, but I also always took notes.
Mm-hmm.
That helps.
You mean you have to journal?
Oh, I have notes in all sorts of notebooks and crossword puzzles where I write
good
stuff all over.
Smart guy.
And books and books and pages.
Smart guy. Okay. Stephen, thank you for being here. But
my
I want to ask one final question.
Yes.
We were exchanging, again, off microphone, we were exchanging thoughts about the current movie season.
Yes.
And all of the screening, screeners, Oscar bait, Oscar fair, and all that. And I asked you what you thought was the most underappreciated movie you'd seen of late, and you made me very happy with your answer, which is
Sing Street.
Aw, it's easy.
I love that movie.
You have to run, don't walk, to see Sing Street. It is an Irish film. It is magnificent. It will have you laughing and crying and cheering, and the music's so good, and it's just wonderful about survival and about artistry, and it's just life-affirming. I just absolutely love Sing Street. Don't miss it. And I want to throw one more thing out.
Sure.
Because I know now, when I was going through the red carpet for One Day at a Time, one of the photographers pulled me aside and said, I am such a fan of Leonard Maltin. He said, I heard you on his podcast once. Mm-hmm. He is so magnificent. I know so many young people listen to you and listen to the podcast. I know they do. I hear it out there. One thing I would like to say about underappreciated films, I've begun teaching now, occasionally doing master classes at schools in film. A lot of film students don't know the great old films.
No, they don't.
They just pass them by. So they think it's not relevant. So I want to throw this out. And that is The Best Years of Our Lives. It is a film that is magnificent on so many levels, and I have talked to so many people in film schools, film classes, and students who have never seen it, and I say, you must see the movie.
I was channel surfing the other day, or I walked through the room, and my wife had Turner Classic Movies on, and they were showing that. And I just watched a little bit. Which is hard to do.
Hard to do.
Very hard to walk away when that's on. William Wyler's great, great movie about returning veterans, returning soldiers from World War II and the experience of coming home from what was considered a good war, a just war, a necessary war. And it's three very different people, three different men, different strata of society, different home lives, but all facing a major readjustment in their lives. And I think it's as timely and as moving as ever.
Yes.
Great, great film.
Yes.
Great choice, Stephen.
There we go.
But you've got good taste. We already know that. And thank you for the lovely compliment for passing that along. I appreciate that.
Oh, you're big out there.
Big. God bless them all. And God bless you for being here and for doing what you do. Keep on doing what you do.
So where do people find your podcast?
Yes.
Well, the podcast is amazingly, it has been re-put up on iTunes. Okay. So all 71 podcasts complete are on iTunes now. It's also on slashfilm.com.
Okay.
And the new ones are going to start coming out. David Chen and I are meeting, I think, tomorrow or whatever to start putting the finishing touches on the podcast. They're going to start coming out in a week or two, and okay. people will hear new stories.
And you tweet?
I tweet at Tobolowsky, and I'm on Facebook. I have a couple or three different Facebook things. There's Stephen Tobolowsky at Facebook.com, but also there's a Tobolowsky Files site on Facebook. And also, you know, you could write me, if you will. Yes, I'm going to give you my email
right.
address.
Oh, see, I was thinking like is, attached to a raven. No.
You have to just spell my name correctly, Stephen Tobolowsky at gmail.com, and that's STEPHENT as in Tom, O, B as in boy, OLOWSKY.
The Russian spelling.
Russian spelling at gmail.com.
Stephen, I hope people take you up on all of those offers and opportunities because they will be richly rewarded for it. And thank you once again. Jesse, we've done it again. We've got another great guest.
I don't know how.
The time just flies.
We trick them, don't we?
Yeah, yeah. They keep coming. They just keep coming. I don't know. And we'll have another wonderful guest next week. So until then, I am on Twitter, at Leonard Maltin. And I'm writing as much as I can at leonardmaltin.com. So come on over and see what I've got to say.
And you can even find him on the Facebook.
That's true. Jesse, adios till next time.
Ta-ta for now.
Bye-bye. Adios.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.